Josh, thank you very much. This is year number six, and we do have a wonderful, interesting term to talk about this afternoon. I want to thank the Student Legal Forum, of which I was a member when I was a student here at UNLV, for sponsoring these events. I think it's a great way to kick off the year. And our plan, as you know, is to review selected cases from the term that's just concluded, the 2006-2007 term of court. We have three of my colleagues. They've been carefully chosen for their merit and their eloquence among many candidates who would like to have been on this panel. These were the finalists. This is American Hero Law School style. But you don't get to vote for which panelists you like the best. That's not part of the plan. Lillian Bevere, a respected colleague, J.D. from Stanford, who's been here at the law school since 1973. She is the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia. She recently won the University of Virginia Alumni Association's Distinguished Professor Award for her excellence in teaching, and she is especially well known for her scholarship on the First Amendment. John Cannon, J.D. from the University of Pennsylvania, has been here at the University of Virginia since 1998. He directs the law school's environmental and land use law program. He was, before he came to the law school, the general counsel at EPA in Washington, and he has written extensively in the, among other things, the environmental area. Finally, to the far right, Jim Ryan, who is a University of Virginia graduate, where he was a Dillard Scholar and the winner of many of our prizes. He has also been at UVA since 1998. And he is the William L. Matheson and Robert M. Morgenthau Distinguished Professor of Law here. He's now, in addition to being a professor, the Associate Academic Dean. He clerked for Chief Justice William Rehnquist, which makes his contribution especially interesting for our review of the Supreme Court. And his scholarship includes, in particular, extensive work on law and educational opportunity. Now, this is the fall of 2007. It's now been 2 years since the summer of 2005, at which time it had been 11 years since there had been any change in the makeup of the Supreme Court. Been absolute stability, no vacancies, and then suddenly things began to shake loose in the summer of 2007, beginning with the announcement by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor that she was planning to step down. Then followed a sequence of events which have reshaped the face of the Supreme Court in ways that we will find important this afternoon. After her announcement and after President Bush had nominated John Roberts to fill the O'Connor seat on the court, then unexpectedly Chief Justice Rehnquist died. President Bush then nominated John Roberts to the Rehnquist seat as Chief Justice rather than the O'Connor seat. He then named Samuel Alito to fill O'Connor's seat, and finally both Roberts and Alito were confirmed by the Senate. So we saw in 2005, the concluding chapter in the Rehnquist Court and the opening chapter in the Roberts Court. And when the Rehnquist Court set sail, that was 1986, when Warren Burger retired and William Rehnquist was elevated to the Chief Justiceship, the Warren Court at that time still cast its shadow on the Supreme Court. I mean, the Warren Court ended its tenure in 1969, but in a very real sense, the Warren Court had not left the picture because Thurgood Marshall and William Brennan were still on the Supreme Court in 1986. And even though there was the glimmering of a conservative bloc on the Supreme Court, it was still only a distant prospect in terms of really developing. Rehnquist, at the time he became Chief Justice, frequently had been a lone dissenter, a lot of 8-1 decisions when he was Associate Justice. 1986, Scalia had just been appointed. We didn't yet know for sure what kind of justice he would be. Clarence Thomas was not yet on the court. So the counter-revolution that people had predicted when the Burger Court was beginning to take shape, the counter-revolution they thought would come about when President Nixon put four justices on the court between 1969 and 1972, simply had not happened. It simply had not come to pass. So from 1986 to 2005, a great deal took place. By that time, not yet a conservative working majority, but there was beginning to be some reshaping of the court. And I think it would have been possible by the end of the Rehnquist Court to see several distinctive characteristics of that body. First place, in terms of personnel, there was no one left on the Supreme Court in 2005 who'd been on the Warren Court. Complete turnover, and indeed of the 9 serving justices, 7 of them had been appointed by Republican presidents, only 2 by a Democrat. Doctrine, as you all of you who've studied constitutional law know, doctrine had evolved in important ways. For example, federalism, which the Warren Court largely neglected, made a big comeback in cases like U.S. versus Lopez, in 10th Amendment, 11th Amendment, Commerce Clause cases. Federalism became a real part of the docket during the Rehnquist Court. There were other areas. Wall of separation between church and state began to erode. There were school desegregation cases. Rehnquist hoped to get the court out of the business of running schools was beginning to take hold. But there was nevertheless, and I think it's fascinating that even at the end of the Rehnquist era, there were persistences of ideas, indeed some surprising developments, one of which was that substantive due process, which was a flickering sort of flame back in the 1960s, really had flared into life by the end of the 20th century. For example, Lawrence versus Texas, the gay rights case from Texas, overruling Bowers versus Hardwick, showed how vital the autonomy or privacy principle had become. One other example, the cruel and unusual punishment cases, the Rehnquist Court actually overruled 2 of its own precedents in extending the reach of those circumstances thought to violate the 8th Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. I think it's fair to say that by the close of the Rehnquist Court, that there was still a center of gravity on the court, and that center had held, thanks in particular to Justice O'Connor, partly thanks to Justice Kennedy. We were reminded that though there was beginning to emerge a serious conservative bloc on the court, that the movement conservatives, if you like, Rehnquist and Thomas and Scalia, still had to pick up those other 2 votes, and they didn't always have them. So as a result, by the end of the Rehnquist Court, there were still very sharp debates, sharper in some respects than even the debate on the Warren Court, over such things as methodology, the question of originalism, how should we read the Constitution, debates over what Justice Scalia called elitism on the part of the majority in cases like Lawrence versus Texas, debate even over whether the court should be referring to international norms or not, as Kennedy did in the Texas case. So at the end of the Rehnquist Court, we found a court which had been striking out in some fairly bold ways. It seemed, for the most part, to have been a fairly self-confident, even aggressive court. It overruled acts of Congress at a faster clip per term than even the Warren Court had done in the 1960s. And, of course, this was the court that gave us Bush versus Gore. I think one would have to call that an act of self-confidence on the Supreme Court's part. But it seemed to me, and I can't quite measure the whys and wherefores of this, but somewhere about 2002, the last 2 or 3 years of the Rehnquist Court, it seemed like some of the wind was going out of that self-confident sail, and that the court was beginning to be more tentative in some respects, more narrow opinions, kicking questions back to district courts, deciding cases more narrowly, throwing out cases on standing like the Pledge of Allegiance case from California, leading Cass Sunstein to comment that the court was in some ways a court of minimalist jurisdiction. Well, that was the end of the Rehnquist Court. Now we're into the Roberts Court era. We have 2 years under our belt of the Roberts Court. A year ago, when we met to talk about what the court had done in 2005-2006, the first term of the Roberts Court, it was still too early to get a reading on what this court was going to be like. For one thing, O'Connor was still sitting for several months. Alito did not take his seat until January of 2006. And it was really only in the closing months of that court that the court began to move into more controversial areas and apparently was shifting towards the right. The highest agreement rate, interestingly enough, in that term was Roberts and Alito. Nevertheless, if you were here a year ago, you may recall the comment that this was a mixed scorecard, that the 2005-2006 term was not a term that was clearly moving in one direction or the other. There were cases in which the president's effort to use military commissions was rejected by the court. The court gave a victory to the Republicans in the Texas reapportionment case. But on the other hand, they rebuffed the attorney general's effort to move against doctors in Oregon who were acting under that state's assisted suicide case. And they avoided, there was an abortion case where they went off on very narrow ground. So you had the sense that the 2005-2006 term was a term of tentative, mixed kind of gropings, as it were, and not clear where it would be going. We are now at the 2006-2007 term, the one that we're about to review with our panel. And let me simply put several thoughts on the table, some of which may surface in remarks which are to follow. First, I think you can begin to see the more aggressively conservative thrust of the Supreme Court, manifestly the effect of Samuel Alito taking the seat of Sandra Day O'Connor. He is not simply her replacement. He is clearly to her right. There are areas of, it seems to me, more conservative. The abortion case would be an example where the court upheld the federal so-called partial birth abortion case, distinguishing very, I thought, not very persuasively, an earlier precedent involving a state statute, which in many ways was very much like the federal statute. You will hear during our discussion about the school cases in which the court has gone in a more conservative direction. I think also conservatism is to be measured by not only by substantive outcome, but by technique and methodology. And it was a court, it seems to me that this term of the Rehnquist Court has been more inclined to enforce rather strictly things like filing deadlines, one case which seemed cruel to those who were critics of it, and a case where they very strictly enforced a very strict reading of a federal anti-discrimination employment statute. Are we beginning to see the fruits in the Roberts Court of the efforts that began at least with the Reagan administration in the early 80s, the Reagan Justice Department, who, disappointed by Nixon's failure to change the face of the court, Reagan and Ed Meese and others clearly were setting out not to make that mistake again. Are we seeing the fruits of that effort being born in this term? It's interesting that both Roberts and Alito came to Washington as young lawyers in the Reagan Justice Department, and here they are 25 years later on the Supreme Court. Now, it seems to me, as you look at the conservative ranks on the court, there seem to be two pairs of justices that Roberts and Alito seem to be fairly closely aligned. Thomas and Scalia seem to be fairly close. President Bush had said he would like to appoint to the court justices in the mold of Thomas and Scalia. But as you may know from reading some of this term's cases, Scalia and Thomas are much more aggressive in how far they would like to go, for example, overturning precedent. Alito and Roberts seem to be more step-by-step incrementalists, and therefore not prepared to go as far as their two colleagues would go. Nevertheless, it's clear that even if the pace is different, the four of them do appear to be moving in the same direction, ultimately a conservative direction. Kennedy now becomes the fifth vote. I mean, he's bound to like, now that O'Connor is gone, he's the man, isn't it? You've got to have his vote. But he also is not O'Connor. It seems to me that he is somebody who, by and large, in the ideologically divided 5-4 cases during this past term, typically came down to the conservative side. There were one or two interesting exceptions. I think when Jim Ryan talks about the school cases, I'm sure he'll have something to say about the Kennedy concurrence, where he stopped short of how far Chief Justice Roberts would go. The dissenters manifestly show a frustration. The four more liberal justices on the court, their dissents show it. They're more likely to read their dissents from the bench. There seem to be more edge to them. Ginsburg, for example, seems to be afraid that some of her legacy is unraveling. Breyer was especially heated in his dissent, his 77-page dissent in the school cases, taking, I think, about 20 minutes in the courtroom to actually present his dissents. The divisions, as I say, are frequently 5-4. One-third of this term's cases, 54 of them, were 5-4 decisions. Chief Justice Roberts had told us about his hopes for consensus. Whatever those hopes may have been, they haven't shown up in this particular term. There were several important cases in which there were no majority opinions. The Hine case involving the White House faith-based initiatives program, the campaign reform case from Wisconsin, and the two school cases from Louisville and Seattle. So that's the kind of term we've got. It's still early in the Roberts Court. We're going to have the Roberts Court, I think, for a very long time, if assuming health and takes care of himself. We've got a quarter of a century or more of Chief Justice Roberts. Will these divisions persist? Might there be future vacancies? If so, whom and who will replace them? It all points to, if any of you are political activists, I'm sure you're already thinking about 2008 and who's going to be in the White House and who might appoint the next justices. Well, that's just a little bit of background. I wanted to give you a sense of some overview. Now we come to the meat of the program, which is to say my three colleagues, who we're not going to try to do it all. I mean, we've been very selective. There are important cases that we're not going to try to talk about. We'd rather spend more time on a few cases to help give you a sense of what the court's about. And we will hear from my colleagues in the following order. Lillian Bevere will talk about First Amendment cases. John Cannon about the court's environmental decisions, and finally Jim Ryan to talk about the school cases. At the end of the program, as Josh commented, we will, rather than taking questions from the audience, we will adjourn. There will be a reception. I'm told that the forum has spent heavily to provide food and drink. Students love nothing better than a handout, so this is your chance to pauper the forum by eating and drinking heavily today. And I'm sure the panelists will be happy to have you to approach them for questions after the program. So let me therefore turn first to Lillian Bevere.
Let me say first, you've got some people in the back. There are seats in the front, and we're not going to call on you. So please, you just might be more comfortable. Okay, I'm going to talk about the free speech cases, of which there were four. I expect I'll be talking pretty fast. One of the cases held that a high school football coach who was disciplined by the State Athletic Association for recruiting violations had no First Amendment claim. Another held that it's not unconstitutional for a state to require agency shop public employee unions to get the affirmative permission of non-union members before they use their fees for political purposes. But I'm not going to talk about either one of those cases. I think they're very interesting, but I've got a couple of more interesting cases to talk about, namely the campaign finance case and the bong hits for Jesus, which I know you've been waiting eagerly to hear all about. The campaign finance case, Wisconsin Right to Life versus FEC. First of all, I have to preface this by telling you that campaign finance regulation and the First Amendment doctrine that has accompanied it, as it has developed in the last 30 years or so, is opaque beyond belief. If you ever wanted to craft a set of rules, regulations, and doctrines that made it impossible for you to talk about them without people's eyes glazing over it, this is what you would do. So to tell you anything about Wisconsin Right to Life, I'm just going to have to be so cryptic that it may be sort of, I don't mean to make it inaccessible, it's the only way I can talk about it at all. In 2002, the McCain-Feingold campaign finance regulation reforms were passed by Congress, major, major reforms. Section 203 of that statute prohibited the expenditure of corporate or union treasury funds on, quote, electioneering communications, which has a specific definition, namely, broadcast ads that mention a federal candidate by name within 30 days of a primary or 60 days of a general election. The idea here was supposedly to prevent corporations and unions from attempting, by spending money, to influence the outcome of federal candidate elections. Section 203 was widely thought to be unconstitutional, even by its drafters and promoters. In signing it, President Bush was kind of counting on the courts to declare it unconstitutional, but no way, Jose. The Supreme Court, by a vote of 5-4, with Justice O'Connor in the majority, voted to sustain Section 203 against a facial attack. The majority in McConnell quite trivialized any First Amendment concerns that had bothered people about Section 203. It didn't really even talk about free speech when it was addressing Section 203. Instead, it just said we have to defer to the legislature when it comes to the special characteristics of the corporate structure that requires particularly careful regulation of corporate political speech. And again and again and again, the majority in McConnell invoked the specter of immense aggregations of corporate wealth to justify substantial restrictions on political speech by corporations. First Amendment was, in some views, dead on arrival after McConnell. It was, with respect to campaign finance speech, it was over. Then Justice O'Connor resigned, and then Chief Justice Rehnquist died, and Roberts and Alito joined the court. And meanwhile, back at the ranch in 2004, Wisconsin Right to Life, which describes itself as a grassroots lobbying organization, it's a nonprofit organization. I think you might be able to guess what its principal agenda is by its name. It wanted to broadcast an ad that mentioned Senator Feingold by name in Wisconsin in the context of talking about a then ongoing filibuster in the Senate of judicial nominees. This ad was going to run afoul of 203 because of its timing. So Wisconsin Right to Life brought an as-applied challenge to Section 203, which, remember, had been sustained on its face. Their basic claim was, look, we're talking about an issue. We're not talking about a candidate. We're trying to get people to contact their senator about an issue. And we have a constitutional right to talk about issues, and therefore Section 203 cannot constitutionally be applied to us. And the newly constituted court this term, 5-4, refused to overrule McConnell on this point, but it nevertheless sustained the as-applied challenge. Now, Chief Justice Roberts' opinion for who knows who, about three people, we're not really sure, it effectively, if not formally, overruled McConnell with respect to Section 203. This is not just my view. It is the view of both Justice Scalia, who wanted him to go all the way. McConnell should have been overruled, and he said Justice Roberts was guilty of faux judicial restraint for refusing to overrule it. And Justice Souter, on the four minority side, said that the majority really, in effect, did overrule McConnell, and this was the end of the world as we know it. So it's kind of hard to argue from any point of view that there's anything left of McConnell, because it's so easy to fit within Chief Justice Roberts' test for what speech must be protected, despite the literal language of 203. The head of McConnell has been chopped off. Its heart has been taken out. So what's otherwise noteworthy about Wisconsin Right to Life? Well, lots of things. I'm going to talk about two of them. One is sort of the old news, the kind of conservative split among the two and two, whether to overrule or just chip away. Scalia was scathing on this, as in a couple of other opinions, with respect to Chief Justice Roberts' caution. But my point really is, in important ways, Justice Scalia looks this gift horse in the mouth, because the Roberts opinion is almost, maybe that's the important word for him, but it's almost all one could have wished for from a free speech point of view. He said he was very firm with respect to the holding that burdens on political speech have to be strictly scrutinized, and the government bears the burden. The government bears the burden of proving that the Section 203, as applied in each case to which it is applied, furthers a compelling state interest and is narrowly tailored. And he insists that the section be interpreted in the future so as to provide, this is so important, a safe harbor for those who wish to exercise First Amendment rights. So this, from the point of view of those who support regulation, turns Wisconsin Right to Life into a total disaster, because it reinvigorates First Amendment review of campaign finance regulations, which had been thought to be a dead letter after McConnell. The other interesting thing I'm going to talk about with respect to this case is sort of a variation on the old news, there's a conservative-liberal divide on the court. My variation is not much of one, except one of emphasis. It's not a divide, it's a philosophical chasm. The advocates of free political speech on one side and the proponents of regulation on the other. Now, one commentator has described this chasm as pitting Madisonians who are basically conservatives on this issue. They support freedom. They think freedom is the answer. They think more speech is the answer, no matter who it comes from. It's just the more the better. And progressives on the other side, who liberals, who favor regulation, who think freedom of political speech is the problem, and they are, I think they're quite obsessed with this idea of money in politics. They believe both that it can be regulated out of influence, and that our democracy can be sort of regulated into perfection. I invite you to look at the political world and see whether we need a reality check there, but we'll just put that aside. What scares me about this chasm is that I don't see a way of bridging it. Richard Gephardt, who used to be majority leader in the House, once said, "What we have is two important values in direct conflict: free speech and our desire for healthy campaigns in a healthy democracy. You can't have both," he said. I'm not sure that he's not right about that, and that's scary to me. Next, okay, bong hits for Jesus. Student speech, a case that the ACLU probably should never have agreed to litigate on behalf of the student, that the student should never have gotten to first base on, that the court itself should never have taken, and which they probably agreed to take for sort of a nice reason, but they probably agreed to take it only in order to avoid having the principal of Juneau High School have to pay damages to this kid who had flown the banner. At oral argument, indeed, when the student's attorney got up to argue his side of the case, after the court had been haranguing one another about student speech rights for half an hour, and the attorney for the student got up, Chief Justice Roberts looked at him and he said, "This is a case about money, isn't it? You want money for your client." Well, that kind of takes the wind out of your First Amendment sails, but nevertheless, it put it a little bit in perspective about what was on the court's mind. First Amendment rights of students have been indistinctly defined ever since Tinker in 1969, when the court sustained a student's right to wear black armbands in protest of the Vietnam War on the ground that you can't sanction students for speaking unless there's substantial disruption. But the court has really pulled back from that in two later cases, Bethel versus Frazier, which said it's okay to discipline students who engage in lewd speech at a school assembly, and secondly, Hazelwood versus Kuhlmeier, which said it's okay to discipline student speakers when they're speaking as a curricular matter, when they're writing in the student newspaper and people are going to think it's part of the curriculum for them to say these awful things, then you can discipline them for it. Right. Well, Bong Hits for Jesus is a case in which you probably know the facts. The Olympic torch was coming through Juneau. The principal led all the students out of the high school. TVs were going to be there. And Mr. Frederick and some of his friends decided it would be fun to try to get on TV. So they made this banner. It's a 14-foot banner, and it says, "Bong Hits for Jesus." Well, guess what the principal did when she saw this banner? She said, mm-mm-mm-mm. So she ran across the street. She said, "Take the banner down." They said, "No." She said, "Take it down." They finally did roll it up and took it down. And this happened, that happened. Eventually, the student was disciplined, i.e., he was suspended for a few days. And that's the basis of his First Amendment claim. It was unconstitutional to suspend me. Now, he lost the case with Chief Justice Roberts writing an opinion in which he really strains. So you think what Bong hits for Jesus means. What do you think? Well, never mind. He strains to find the banner has a message. It's a serious message. It promotes illegal drug use. And the message is one that the government has a strong interest in countering, because we have a strong interest in preventing illegal drug use. So he says it doesn't matter if there wasn't disruption, because Tinker isn't the last word on how we can discipline student speech. What matters is Bethel versus Frazier, which sustained the regulation of student speech when the speech was engaged in lewd antics. And that case, he said, established that the students' constitutional rights truly don't end at the schoolhouse door, but they also are not coextensive with those of an adult in an ordinary setting. And also, he said, sometimes disciplining student speech is necessary on account of the special characteristics of the school environment. Well, despite being pretty clear that Tinker is not the final answer and last word, and that disruption isn't always required in order to discipline student speakers, Chief Justice Roberts' opinion seems really calculated to avoid most of the hard issues. For example, what would have happened if, with no disruption, there had been a different message on the banner, say, legalize marijuana, or take Jesus Christ into your life, or embrace your inner gay self, a more explicitly political message, or even a religious message, but one not embraced by the school, not approved by the school, and controversial? Same result, different result. Who knows? What would have happened, what is exactly special about the school environment? What is constitutionally relevant about it? Chief Justice Roberts noted that school officials have a difficult job, which I think is a true fact. I can speak to this fact. But if that's what matters, why does it matter for purposes of the students' constitutional rights in school? Doesn't say. What about other school policies? I mean, suppose the school adopts policies to discourage premarital sex or unwed motherhood or tolerance toward gays. Would the court permit them to be invoked in behalf of restrictions on student speech? Who knows? Okay, so that's Chief Justice Roberts. Answers a question, doesn't answer a lot of questions. Then we get to the really wonderful concurrences. I think they're wonderful. They're interesting. First of all is Justice Thomas, who would have us go back to an earlier and simpler time when schools were in loco parentis. The Constitution had nothing to do with it. Teachers taught, students learned. End of story. It sounds like heaven to me. He also, in the course of this historical exegesis, emphasizes actually what the thing that I think is the most important thing that kind of gets lost in these cases. Justice Breyer does this too, I think, and we'll talk about that. The question is whether courts are well-placed to make the judgment calls that are necessary to make final decisions about when discipline needs to be imposed on students. He questioned that assumption. And then Alito, who basically said, okay, this far, I will say that all this case does is to say that school officials can permit restrictions on speech that promotes illegal drug use, but no farther. That's it. And certainly we're not going to permit schools to discipline students to the extent that Ken Starr had wanted them to, arguing on behalf of the Juneau School Board, saying school can censor any student speech that interferes with a school's educational mission. That was a little extreme. But Alito's opinion has been widely interpreted as having a hidden agenda as of being designed really to make sure that students who get disciplined for engaging in religious speech, in particular anti-gay or anti-abortion speech in schools, and there have been a lot of them, will have First Amendment rights preserved. I think that's what people are reading him as saying. Justice Breyer concurred in the result, but he said we shouldn't have even gotten to the First Amendment question. Why? Because it's too hard. It's very difficult to figure out what the rule should be here. We can't give school administrators any guidance. Because we can't do that, we shouldn't have tried. He says students will test, not high school students, will test the limits of authority in ways teachers understand better than judges do. Teachers need a degree of flexibility with respect to discipline. Detailed supervision by courts engenders more disputes among teachers and students, which in turn engenders more litigation. Yet no one, says Justice Breyer, wishes to substitute courts for school boards or to turn the judges' chambers into the principal's office. Then Justice Stevens, so interesting in dissent, he takes the position that the student speech doesn't mean anything. If it has any message at all, it's ambiguous. So from this understanding of the content, he draws a conclusion that because it doesn't mean anything and because it doesn't violate a rule or expressly advocate anything, because the banner was nonsense designed not to make an important political statement but only to try to get on TV, it's protected by the First Amendment. In other words, he says, speech by students that's, in his words, meaningless and funny, nonsensical, curious, ridiculous, obscure, and stupid, and is designed simply to get attention and to get on TV is, for that reason, protected by the First Amendment from discipline by school authorities. Now, think what you will. It's difficult for me, at least, to find a real First Amendment value in one which impels the Supreme Court of the United States to step in to vindicate it in requiring school authorities to permit students to engage in attention-getting, nonsense, stupid, ridiculous speech. I think Justice Breyer had it right. He said to say that school officials might reasonably prohibit students during school-related events from unfurling 14-foot banners with any kind of message designed to attract attention from TV cameras seems unlikely to undermine basic First Amendment principles. So I have to conclude by saying that the court did decide four free speech cases, and we can say what the results of those cases were. It's very difficult to go beyond that and offer any useful generalization or prediction about where the Roberts Court will go from here, and the reason is, it reminds me of a pudding that Winston Churchill was once served, and he said, well, it was a very nice pudding, but it rather lacked a theme. Thank you.
John?
All right. So thank you for coming and giving us the opportunity to talk about cases that we care about. And I'm going to talk to you about the environmental cases of the last term, which were also four in number. Four seems to be, I don't know how many education
cases.
Just
one.
Just one. But it takes four environmental cases to make up for one education cases, because the education cases.
Very long.
Very long, right. As in the case of free speech, the four cases don't add up to more than the sum of their parts. So I'm going to talk about them seriatim, but I'm going to try to give an overview of the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, or at least the reactions of environmental law scholars to the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in the past, just to give you a setting from which to talk about the cases that the court decided last term. For a long time, for many decades, environmental law scholars, and these are scholars mostly of the environmentalist persuasion, have been critical of the lackluster performance of the court, in their view, in environmental cases. And there are several elements to this claim. One, they say the court has selected cases of little or no legal or policy importance. They say that the court hasn't taken any cases that environmentalists have wanted it to hear over the Solicitor General's objections. That is, the court has been the tool, if you will, of the Solicitor General in deciding what cases to hear or not to hear. The criticism continues that when the court has taken cases, it has decided them with little sense of what makes environmental law special. Whatever that is, there's something special in environmental law, and the court doesn't get it. It has no environmental voice. And that has made it largely irrelevant to the development of environmental law in the view of these scholars. So these were the criticisms. I think this grousing had also something to do with the trend of the cases that the Supreme Court did decide in terms of outcome. That is, people who keep count of these things made note that the court decided more cases to produce anti-environmental results than pro-environmental results. Now, those aren't statistics that mean anything, given the process by which the court selects its cases, but I think that was a concern that some commentators, at least, had subconsciously, if not consciously. So that is background. I think as in recent years, it's become harder and harder to make those criticisms. And I think with the court's performance in the last term, it's impossible to make these criticisms. And I'm going to try to explain why. In this term, or in this last term, the court decided four important environmental law cases. Decided four cases, all of them were important. One of them, Massachusetts v. EPA, was more important than the others, but they all had significance. Two of those cases, Massachusetts v. EPA and another Clean Air Act case, Environmental Defense versus Duke Energy, the court took over the government's opposition. That is, the Solicitor General had argued that cert should not be granted in both of those cases, and the court took the cases. Notwithstanding, that's the first time, and it happened twice in one term, that the court has done that in environmental cases. In these four cases, the court addressed constitutional, administrative law, and statutory interpretation questions with major bearing on the implementation of environmental programs and national environmental policy. There was nothing trivial or pointless about any of these cases. In three of the four cases, the decision was pro-environment, and I think even more significantly, in two of those pro-environment rulings, there was a unanimous court, that is, the rulings had the support of the conservative justices as well as the liberals on the court. So let me mention briefly the three less important cases, and then I'll move on to try to comment more fully on Massachusetts v. EPA, which is the big case, environmental case of this last season. In Environmental Defense versus Duke Energy, the court upheld EPA regulations interpreting the Clean Air Act's provisions governing new sources. The issue broadly was whether the agency could have two different definitions of the same statutory term, modification, in determining the applicability of two different regulatory requirements. Now, it may seem odd to you that the agency would define the same statutory term in two different ways for two different applications. EPA does this all the time. Maybe it's just to make things complicated, but the idea is that in different settings, different definitions of the same term may be appropriate. And the court upheld this practice in this particular case. It said that where the statutory term was fairly susceptible to both interpretations, where Congress hadn't indicated an intent that the agency only use one interpretation, and where there was a reasonable basis for using different interpretations, EPA's approach was fine. This is not surprising for those of you who are familiar with administrative law cases and the way the courts have handled agency discretion in these cases. Here, I think it has important consequences because it allowed the agency to maintain an interpretation which was critical to an enforcement effort against major sources of air pollution that had commenced under the Clinton administration and was continuing under President Bush. So this had important policy consequences for an ongoing program and the unanimous support of all the justices. In U.S. v. Atlantic Richfield, the court overruled an interpretation of the Superfund statute, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, CERCLA, that would have prevented parties responsible for cleanup of contaminated property from bringing a cost recovery action against other responsible parties after voluntarily cleaning up the property themselves. This outcome, interestingly, was urged both by environmental groups and by industry groups interested in encouraging voluntary cleanups and in disciplining responsible parties who did nothing on their own initiative to clean up sites. And again, a unanimous court found room in the statute to accommodate this interpretation. The one sour note for environmentalists in this last term was National Association of Home Builders versus Defenders of Wildlife. In this split decision, the court limited one of its most famous environmental decisions, TVA v. Hill, which had held, that's a snail darter case, right? Little snail darter, big dam. The court stopped the dam in that case, notwithstanding the argument that there was $50 million worth of sunk costs in the dam and that the economic impacts of stopping the dam would far outweigh any adverse impacts of losing the snail darter. The court in that case, in a ringing opinion by Chief Justice Berger, held that Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act imposes mandatory duties on federal agencies proposing actions that might affect listed species. In the case last term, the National Association of Home Builders case, the court held that agencies' duties under Section 7 were limited to discretionary actions, depending on how the lower courts interpret discretionary in subsequent cases. I think the decision has some capacity to qualify a decision, TVA v. Hill, which has stood for decades as the court's clearest and most resonant affirmation of environmental mandates. Looking at it from the other side, it has the capacity to inject some reason into the application of the Section 7 requirements under the Endangered Species Act. All right, all this brings me to Massachusetts v. EPA, and I'm going to talk about that as much as I have time left. I could talk about it for a long time. I love this case. It's a great case. And Lillian and Jim and probably Dick have all heard me talk about it before, so
it's never enough.
Yeah. Talk on.
You know, if this were a reality show, I'd probably get voted off the island right now. But it's not. This is totally unreal. Okay. Massachusetts v. EPA is the, surprisingly, the court's first case dealing with climate change, and it is a major case with major implications both for EPA's legal authorities and for climate change policy more generally in the United States. And it also has a nice constitutional issue. Mostly environmental cases are cases of statutory interpretation. They're not very flashy or sexy or of general interest. I mean, talking about environmental laws with all the acronyms can put people to sleep much faster than talking about First Amendment doctrine. But here we have a constitution. I'll raise it. Here we have a case which has a major constitutional standing issue at its core, and I'm going to spend some time talking about that because I think it's something that hopefully everybody will be interested in. Here's how the case began. In 1999, a coalition of environmental groups filed a rulemaking petition with EPA asking the agency to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from new motor vehicles under Title II of the Clean Air Act. Title II requires EPA in some circumstances to set emission standards for automobiles manufactured or sold in the United States. EPA denied the rulemaking petition on two grounds. One, that EPA lacked the statutory authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, because greenhouse gases were not air pollutants within the meaning of the Act. And the agency also held or decided in the alternative that even if it did have the authority, regulating greenhouse gas emissions at this time would be unwise. This decision was upheld by a divided panel of the D.C. Circuit, and the Supreme Court reversed. In an opinion by Justice Stevens, which was joined by Justices Kennedy, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer, the court concluded that at least one of the environmental petitioners, the state of Massachusetts, had standing to bring the case. On the merits, it held that EPA had the statutory authority to regulate CO2 emissions, greenhouse gas emissions under the Act, and in declining to regulate, the agency had failed to meet its statutory obligations. So, a ringing victory for the environmentalists who were pushing this case as a way to unlock the national policy process on climate change. Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito dissented both on standing and on the merits. The decision is significant for several reasons. First of all, it defines a major new area of responsibility for EPA in addressing climate change, which has emerged, I think most people will agree, as the most pressing environmental issue of this generation, maybe of the next. It requires the agency to review this and other petitions for regulation of greenhouse gas emissions under constraints on its discretion set up by the court in this case. And EPA has a lot of authorities other than Title II and the automobile emission standards that could potentially be used to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. So this case is just the first step in a series of petitions and proceedings you will see where the agency is challenged to invoke those authorities to create a more comprehensive approach to greenhouse gas emission controls. The third important feature, I think, of the decision is that it marks potential doctrinal innovations, including special solicitude for standing of states in federal litigation and new restrictions on the discretion of executive branch agencies to postpone action, as EPA sought to do here. And I'm going to focus, in the minute and a half I have remaining, to take a closer look at the standing decision. You really have to stop in 15 minutes.
Two minutes.
Okay.
Jim.
Standing. Okay.
The audience, they're on the edges of.
Are they riveted? Yeah. Okay. Well, if they're riveted, I'll do it. Okay. So standing issue was important, right? If you don't have standing, you don't get to make your case on the merits. So it doesn't matter whether CO2 is an air pollutant or not. Right? Nobody cares, or at least the court doesn't care, and therefore you don't get the relief that you're seeking. Standing doctrine requires three elements for establishing a case or controversy under Article 3 of the Constitution. Injury, these are familiar to you. I'll just rehearse them briefly. Injury, causation, right? A relationship between the action complained of and the injury to the plaintiff, and redressability, the ability of the court to redress the injury through relief that it might grant. One of the petitioners, Massachusetts, claimed that it was losing coastline as a result of sea level rise stemming from climate change, that EPA's unlawful refusal to regulate CO2 from automobiles was contributing to that loss, and that a judicial order requiring EPA to reconsider its decision would redress the injury by offering to slow down the rate of loss or reduce the risk of catastrophic harm. So all three elements are addressed, injury, causation, and redressability in that argument, and the court bought the argument. Right? It agreed. Justice Stevens, in doing so, expressed particular solicitude for the standing of Massachusetts as a state, a quasi-sovereign entity, and raised a lot of issues in the course of that I won't get into. But he was careful to make the case for standing in the traditional standing terms, those three elements that I talked about. So it's not clear what effect, if any, his special solicitude for Massachusetts had on the outcome of that analysis. There's speculation that the deference he paid to Massachusetts was there to appeal to Justice Kennedy's Federalist sympathies and get Justice Kennedy to move with the majority or become part of the majority to support the decision. And if you take that view, the special solicitude for Massachusetts really isn't doing any analytical work. And a lot of people, I think, have come to that conclusion. But I can tell you that there will be a lot of future debate in standing issues on climate change about whether states really, the presence of states really makes a difference, and more generally in standing cases. Justice Roberts argued that Massachusetts did not have standing because its injury was not particularized or specific to Massachusetts, part of the injury requirement. He said the very concept of global warming seems inconsistent with the particularization requirements. Now, imagine that had been the majority opinion. That basically rules out standing for environmental petitioners in climate change cases because of the nature of climate change. Its injuries are distributed globally. That is, warming occurs globally, and therefore, under this analysis, you wouldn't be able, as a petitioner or a plaintiff, to show particularization. So, you know, but for the movement of Justice Kennedy, that could have been the law, and we could have had a much different complexion to the options available to climate change plaintiffs in subsequent cases. Roberts also argued that Massachusetts' injury wasn't actionable because it was conjectural. It wasn't clear how much automobile emissions from U.S. vehicles was contributing to sea level rise, certainly to sea level rise in Massachusetts. Therefore, it couldn't be determined how much difference an action by EPA with respect to automobiles would make, whether it would really cause a material change in Massachusetts' situation, and therefore the elements of causation and redressability, Justice Roberts argued, could not be met. Again, if he had prevailed on these issues, it's hard to see how environmental plaintiffs would have standing, given the nature of climate change and the complexity of the climate system, how environmental plaintiffs would have standing to bring these cases in future instances. There's a lot to say about the merits. I'm out of time. Let me just summarize briefly about what I think are the significant implications for this case. First of all, it's going to have a big influence on EPA. EPA now has agreed to do regulations setting emission standards for greenhouse gases from automobiles. And it's going to have to do the same review for other aspects of its authority, as I've mentioned before. I think the decision more broadly has also changed the ground of debate in Congress on climate change legislation, because EPA now has the authority, confirmed by the court, to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Congress's set of options changes. That is, the default option is not no regulation. The default option is regulation by EPA, and some in Congress find that a horrible idea and might be more inclined to think about some sort of national legislation dealing with climate change. Finally, I think the court's opinion, and I've written this elsewhere, and I believe it's true, endorsing as it does the environmentalist views on the reality and seriousness of climate change, provides a rallying point for climate change advocates and a touchstone for the public on these issues, to the extent that the public respects and reveres the Supreme Court as somehow a credible institution. Its opinions in cases like this make a difference. And I think in this case, where there's a lot of controversy about the certainty or uncertainty of the science, what, if anything, the government can do, this statement by the Supreme Court has a significant effect on the public debate. Thank you, and my apologies for not having time.
Okay. Thanks, all of you. I'm going to talk very briefly, because I know it's late, and I too want to get to this increasingly lavish buffet over here, which I've watched being assembled. So I'm just going to cut out all the substance and just hit the jokes that I had included in the 6 pages of notes. I'm going to talk about the voluntary integration cases to give you a sense of what the court decided, which isn't so easy to figure out, which is why I'm using scare quotes around the court, and also to give you a sense of whether it's an important decision. To cut to the chase, my answer about whether it's important is mixed. It's a classic, on the one hand, on the other hand, lawyerly response, which makes me appreciate why President Truman supposedly said that what he really needed was a one-handed lawyer. The name of the case is Parents Involved in Community Schools versus Seattle School District Number 1. At issue were actually two voluntary integration plans, one from Seattle, Washington, and the other from Jefferson County, Kentucky. They're referred to as voluntary integration plans only because they're not imposed by the court but adopted by the local school boards. They weren't voluntary in the sense that students could decide whether they wanted to participate or not. It's not as if the school official said, hey, raise your hand if you want to participate in an integration plan, and those that did were included and those that didn't weren't. You couldn't opt out. That said, the plans did involve school choice. They were both forms of structured school choice, where race was a factor in assignment. It's easiest to understand the Seattle plan. I still don't understand the Kentucky plan after having read it numerous times. In Seattle, under the old plan, every student in the city could choose from one of 10 high schools, and that person would be given his or her first choice unless the school was oversubscribed. If and only if the school was oversubscribed, the city would use a series of tiebreakers. The first would be whether you had a sibling in the school. The second and the one at issue was race. So if you were of a particular race and your going to this school would help racial balance, you would be given an edge over someone from a different race whose entry to the school would disrupt the racial balance. The idea was to create in schools the same general proportion of white and minority students that existed in the district as a whole, with some room on both ends. Seattle divided students somewhat crudely into white was one category and non-white was another category. Jefferson County divided the students into black and other. So there was no distinction really about different minority groups. That said, both the Seattle and the Jefferson County plans, I think it's worth noting, were descendants of earlier, more invasive and more coercive plans that relied much more heavily on race and less so on school choice. In a 5-4 decision, the court struck down both plans. Five different justices wrote opinions totaling 180 pages. I'm just going to comment on the first 50 because that's as far as I got. Actually, I'm going to spend the bulk of my time describing who joined whose opinion. So the Chief Justice wrote the opinion for the court. He was joined by Justices Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito, the so-called conservative bloc. The Chief Justice also wrote an opinion for himself and three of the four other justices in the majority, everyone except Kennedy, which has made it hard for people to know what to call this opinion. Everyone calls it a plurality opinion, but it's not really a plurality opinion because there is an opinion for the court, but I'm going to call it the plurality opinion because it seems weird to call it a concurring opinion given that he also wrote the majority opinion, and it's weird to concur in your own opinion. You see the problem, right? Okay, Justice Thomas wrote a separate concurring opinion, as did Justice Kennedy. Breyer wrote a dissent, a long one. As Dick described, he read long portions of it from the bench. He was joined by Stevens, Souter, and Ginsburg. This is a so-called liberal bloc. And Stevens wrote a separate lone dissent. Now, on a first read through the opinions, you're struck by the sparks flying, struck by the dramatic rhetoric, the heightened emotion, sharp disagreement, and accusations of bad faith that course through this seemingly endless maze of opinions. To cite just two examples, Chief Justice Roberts calls the use of race in student assignments an extreme measure. He accuses Justice Breyer of lawlessness. He claims that voluntary integration is inconsistent with the heritage of Brown and states boldly that the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. So there. In his dissent, Justice Breyer returns the Chief Justice's favor by calling his opinion lawless, and then he says, no, 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 no. He claims that the Chief Justice's opinion distorts precedent and misapplies relevant constitutional principles. He accuses the plurality of breaking Brown's promise of integrated primary and secondary education, and he chastises the plurality for being both radical and reckless, claiming that the plurality's approach risks serious harm to the law and for the nation. I don't know why he says for the nation, but he does, rather than to. The rhetoric suggests that this is a momentous decision, as did the reaction to it from the civil rights community, which was voluminous and pretty harsh. It might surprise you to learn, therefore, that the court actually decided very little. The opinion for the court, and by this I mean the opinion joined by five justices, is actually relatively brief and relatively straightforward. How many of you are first years? Okay. You don't know this yet, and the rest may have forgotten. But in order to use race, in order for the government to use race, the government has to be trying to achieve a compelling interest, and the use of race has to be narrowly tailored. Put in lay terms, this means that the government has to be trying to achieve a really important purpose, and it has to use race only as much as is necessary. What the majority said, and this is all they said, was that that neither district had demonstrated that they really needed to classify students by race in order to achieve racially integrated schools. That is to say, they decided that the plans weren't sufficiently narrowly tailored because the school districts didn't show that the use of race was actually necessary here. The districts might have been able to achieve racial integration by other means, by relying, say, on socioeconomic status or by relying on geography and redrawing attendance zones. It wasn't clear that they had to use race. So that's it. That's all that they decided. The court did not say whether voluntary integration might actually serve a compelling interest. It talked about a couple of compelling interests that the court had recognized in other cases, said that neither applied, and that was it. It's not clear why they talked about those compelling interests, given that they said neither applied and given that they relied on the fact that the plan wasn't narrowly tailored in order to strike down the plans, but so be it. The plurality opinion goes a little bit further and hints at the possibility that voluntary integration just doesn't serve a compelling interest. And if that's true, then it means that you can't take race explicitly into account in student assignments because the goal itself isn't sufficiently important. But it only hints in that direction, and it's only four justices anyway. So all you know from the court itself is that these two plans weren't narrowly tailored because the districts didn't show that race needed to be considered. So you might say, well, that's easy. That's pretty straightforward. The problem is Justice Kennedy in so many ways. he decided to write a separate opinion, a concurring opinion. Now, technically, all of his opinion is dicta or dictum. I can never remember which one is the plural. It's dicta, right? Yeah. It's all dicta, meaning that he joined the majority's opinion. This, I think, has not been focused on as much as it should be. So the majority's opinion is narrow, but it's wide enough to dispose of the cases, which means that everything else is dicta, which means that his concurring opinion is dicta. But I don't think he believes that, because he read portions of his concurring opinion from the bench, which is even rarer than people reading, justices reading dissenting opinions. And as a practical matter, his opinion is controlling because he sets out the circumstances under which race can be used in student assignments, which means that he is on record saying that he would allow race to be used in certain instances. So you've got him saying that, then you've got four dissenting justices who are willing to uphold these two plans, so clearly they're willing to allow race to be used in student assignments. In fact, they're willing to allow it in more circumstances than Justice Kennedy. That is to say, anything that Justice Kennedy likes, these four dissenters are going to like as well. Everyone follow that? So as a practical matter, going forward, what Justice Kennedy thinks about voluntary integration is what matters if you are a school official or a lawyer for a school official. So you have to pay attention to Justice Kennedy's opinion. The problem here is that reading Justice Kennedy's opinion is likely to make your head hurt. He starts out by saying he is willing to recognize, well, he doesn't start out, it's a meandering opinion that I'm going to try to condense. He's willing to recognize that voluntary integration serves a compelling interest. In fact, he identifies two compelling interests, one in student diversity, student body diversity, and the other in overcoming racial isolation. So right there, you've got him saying up front, yes, I believe that there are important enough goals so that, in theory, race can be used in student assignments if it's in an effort to achieve these goals. So far, so good. I mean, it's actually not so good because the two goals in some instances conflict, but let's put that to one side and focus on the means. This is where it gets really sketchy. So remember, in order for race to be used constitutionally, it's got to be in the service of a really important end, and the means have to be narrowly tailored. So Justice Kennedy says that, well, what I'd like is for districts first to try race-neutral means, that is, to use proxies for race. So he suggests that if you want to integrate your schools, instead of dividing students explicitly by race, you ought to think about the attendance boundaries, and given residential patterns, you might think about drawing attendance zones around, say, a black neighborhood and a white neighborhood so that they both go to the same school. Right? You're not explicitly classifying students, but you're doing something for the purpose of achieving racial integration. Or you might think about a school choice plan that takes socioeconomic status into account rather than race. Okay? Everyone gets the idea. So you use these proxies for race, but it's okay to think about and try to achieve racial integration. Now, just a little footnote here. This is a really interesting spin on doctrine, which, if taken seriously, has some pretty important implications for a case by the name of Washington versus Davis, which those of you who have taken constitutional law know, and those of you who will take it will learn all about. And I'm sure you'll remember this point and think, hey, Justice Kennedy said something. Anyway, ask your professors at that point what this opinion means for Washington versus Davis. Now, if, but only if, those race-neutral attempts don't work, then Justice Kennedy says it's okay to directly consider race. But it seems like, and I say it seems like on purpose because it's not entirely clear, but it seems like you've got to consider race as one of a number of other factors. That is, you can't just say, okay, you get to go to this school if you're black and you're going here is going to make the school more integrated, and you get to go to this school if you're white and you're going there is going to make it more integrated. You've got to think of race as one of a number of reasons why someone would go to a particular school. The problem is, in addition to the fact that it's not entirely clear that you have to do this, it's not clear what those other factors are. Justice Kennedy is just breezy on this point. There's no other way to describe it. He says, well, you might consider the age of the students, the need of the parents, the need of the students, the talents of the students, the needs of the school. Okay. But there's no example. So it's left to the imagination exactly which of those factors has to be considered and when, right? So you don't know what proxies exactly can be used, when and if you can go beyond those proxies to actually consider race, and if you actually consider race, what other factors need to be included. All of which is to say that the upshot, aside from lingering confusion, is that districts have some room to consider race, but Justice Kennedy seems to invite the indirect consideration of race, or the covert use of race where it's hidden among a number of other factors, much like the court suggested university admissions officers do in the context of affirmative action. Okay, so brief on is this important, is it not, or why it's not important, why it is. Why it's not important. You know, on the ground, this decision is probably not going to have much of an effect for the simple reason that there aren't that many districts that take race into account in student assignment. That is to say, racial integration is not on the agenda of most school districts. Estimates vary from 100 to 1,000 school districts. 1,000 probably is wrong, but even if we take that, the highest estimate, there are 16,000 school districts. And this is really important. Even in those districts where race is taken into account, very few of them have plans like the ones at issue in Seattle and Jefferson County, where race overlays all student assignments. That is to say, where there's a school choice plan that affects all students, and so a lot of students may or may not get into school based on race. Instead, they might involve one or two magnet schools, which might take race into account, whereas the rest of the schools in the district don't take race into account at all. Or they might have involved consideration of race in drawing attendance boundaries. All which is to say that in relatively few districts do you find race being used in student assignment. Another reason why it's not that important is that part of the reason why race isn't considered and integration isn't being pursued is the court itself. This is too long a story to tell here, but suffice it to say that the court, despite some exceptions and despite some good intentions, over the years has made meaningful integration quite difficult. Their decisions combined with residential segregation have made it such that even if districts wanted to, they might not be able to pursue meaningful integration simply because they don't have the diversity that you would need to achieve meaningful integration. Of the 16,000 school districts, more than half are either 90% white or 90% minority. In those districts, it's going to be tough to achieve meaningful integration. So another reason why this case is not that important is because in some ways, the court has not issued a significant favorable opinion, that is a pro-integration or pro-desegregation decision, in over 30 years. And in some ways, this is just a fitting capstone to the court's, I think, largely disappointing experience with desegregation. Even in those districts where race is still being considered because of Justice Kennedy's opinion, and this is the other reason why it may not have that much effect on the ground, leaves some room for maneuvering. Again, because his opinion is so blurry, it's not entirely clear how much room districts have, but it's clear that they have some ability to pursue racial integration. Okay. So now, the other hand, why it's significant. I think there are three reasons. One is that it brings home the fact that this is now Justice Kennedy's court. On hotly contested issues, 5-4 decisions, Justice Kennedy has taken Justice O'Connor's place, and he is the justice who you have to convince if you want to win. And this case is a perfect example. He splits the difference between the dissenters and the plurality here. And indeed, you know, the way the opinions are structured with the dissent talking about the plurality and Justice Kennedy's opinion being somewhat breezy, it wouldn't surprise me to learn in the future that Justice Kennedy was originally completely with the plurality, but at the last minute broke away. Second, it offers a glimpse, but only a glimpse, into the Roberts Court, and I think a somewhat troubling glimpse, insofar as it suggests that this court may not be as restrained or indeed as principled as we might have hoped, at least where something that they really care about is at stake. And by this I mean the opinion seems to contravene some core principles with which the justices in the plurality and also Justice Kennedy have identified themselves, including respect for democratic decision making and specifically in the context of school desegregation, respect for local control of schools as opposed to court control of schools. And yet here you have the court without a clear mandate in the Constitution, and here, you know, I'm bracketing a much larger discussion, but I'm completely confident in saying that it would be hard for you to say that either the text, structure, history, or precedent commands this result. So without a clear mandate in the Constitution, contravening the decisions of locally elected school officials, which seems difficult to square with this professed fealty to democratic decision-making and local control. Last, and this is the most misty-eyed point, no doubt that that racial integration is not on the agenda of most school districts, but I think many who work in the area, and I would include myself in this camp, held out some hope that more districts, and indeed some states through inter-district choice plans, could be persuaded to pursue racial integration, that they might be persuaded of the view that the military and business leaders expressed in the affirmative action cases, that the future and strength of our country depend on working with the diversity that exists in this country and depend on students learning to cooperate with each other rather than avoid each other. To me, the danger and significance of this opinion is that it's going to make an already uphill battle even more difficult to achieve, because I think the message of the opinion, even given Justice Kennedy's willingness to tolerate some uses of race, is that taking race into account is likely to bring trouble. That is, it's likely to bring litigation. There's also this sense from reading the plurality's opinion and Justice Kennedy's concurrence that you have to act somehow with duplicity in order to pursue this, that the whole enterprise is somehow illicit. And I think this may make it even more likely that school officials will decide why bother. And so in that sense, and this is why it's somewhat misty-eyed, I think it takes away some hope that integration would not simply be a dream of the past, but a reality of the future. So on the one hand, the decision is not that practically significant in the short run, but on the other hand, it's no small thing to dash hope. Thanks.
Thank you, Jim.